Hi everyone, and welcome to my podcast, Our Extraordinary Stories. My name is Dr. Devika Patel, and I am an NHS doctor working in the field of psychiatry. This means I support, treat, and help people with mental health illnesses. Now, I haven't done a podcast in a while because I have been enjoying motherhood for the last 8 weeks. So I thought I would take this opportunity to record some solo podcasts while he naps, where I have those few quiet moments during the day. Now, this week is Maternal Mental Health Awareness Week, and I thought it would be the perfect opportunity for me to share briefly my positive-ish birth story and a little update about how my first 8 weeks of motherhood are going. Now, this podcast is all about sharing stories and helping reduce stigma around topics and allowing for people to come together and support each other. Maternal Mental Health Awareness Week is all about raising awareness about mental illness during the maternal period. What I've been thinking about quite a lot is I think the conversation isn't that black and white. It isn't that you either have a mental illness during pregnancy or you don't, because that grey area is where most people will sit. Going through pregnancy, the birth, and the year or 2 years after that, whilst you get used to being a mother, I think there are so many different emotions that come up, and frankly I don't think that society gives us enough time to process that, to talk about it and come together. So I hope that by me sharing my story, it will do a few things. For those that have not been on the journey of motherhood, it will give you an insight into what it's like, and if you are women and you are going to embark on this journey, we'll give you a little bit of a heads up of maybe what to expect. Obviously, this is only my personal experience and I can't cover everything that can happen during pregnancy, birth, or in motherhood. And I just really want it to inspire you to be able to talk openly about the experiences, both the good and the bad, that happened during this time. What I've experienced is that I've had highs and lows during the time, and the lows are very easily forgotten. What that means is you may end up not sharing it, or you may not end up processing some emotions that need processing, and that experience could impact you later on in life. What I've also found is that because the joy of having a baby is just so amazing, it's very easy to forget the difficult times. But those difficult times are useful to share with new mothers, or people that are about to embark on the journey, or people that are supporting new mothers, so that they can have a little insight into what it might be like. There was lots of things that I didn't even think about before I became a mom. Lots of emotions that I experienced. A lot of different new challenges that I had to embark on. And I'm going to share a few of them in this podcast. Now, I've called it my positive-ish birth story, because on paper, actually, my birth was very straightforward. And I couldn't have even written a better birth plan for myself. So it did from the outside look very good. But what I came to realize is it's not just what happens during birth, but it's also the experiences you bring into that delivery room or at the time that you give birth and you go through labor. All of that is going to have an impact on how you process that event and how you feel afterwards. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that too. So it's very much about the physical and the mental side of things, and they come together in quite a whirlwind when you go through the process of giving birth. Now, just a trigger warning that if you have experienced birth trauma, sometimes listening to positive birth stories can be quite difficult. Listening to any birth stories can be difficult. And if that is the case, please do listen with caution. I have put some links to some support services if that would be helpful for you. I remember in the weeks leading up to giving birth, I tried to surround myself in the most positive birth stories as possible. So just listen with caution if you are listening to this. I haven't tried to sugarcoat it, and I've been as transparent and open as possible just to give my honest experience of how birth felt like for me. And this is not to scare any to-be moms. Please only listen if you feel that it is going to be helpful for you, or it might be something that you want to save for after your birth, because you may feel that you resonate with some of the themes that I go through. So I think I'll probably start by talking a little bit about the pregnancy. We were lucky to get pregnant within a few months of trying during that time, I was diagnosed with PCOS, so I had to make some changes to my diet and exercise, which led to a successful, healthy pregnancy. I got diagnosed with high blood pressure that was picked up during the pregnancy. And it actually turned out, when I started thinking about it, that I actually had a high blood pressure that was picked up before the pregnancy, but it really wasn't investigated because they just thought, oh, well, you're young. It's probably something called white coat hypertension, which is you get high blood pressure when you get your blood pressure checked in hospital. However, when I started doing some home readings, it was also high. So yeah, so that was one of the things that came up during the pregnancy. Now, I had my heart set on a home birth, but because of the high blood pressure, it meant that we were going to have to be consultant led. This meant that I couldn't go to a midwife led unit. And this did worry me a little because I wanted the least amount of intervention in my birth. But luckily, it went as well as possible and I was managed by an excellent team. So in my pregnancy, that meant that I did have lots of scans. I had scans all the way up to 38 weeks. I saw a consultant quite a few times and I saw the midwife frequently. And luckily, apart from the high blood pressure, it was a smooth sailing pregnancy. I had something called pelvic girdle pain. Again, this was something that I'd never heard about before I actually started getting the pain. I started getting it about 20, 22 weeks. And basically, the way that I can describe it was I felt like I'd been horse riding for like 2 days straight. And it was this aching pain between my legs. And it was pretty excruciating. It came on with kind of walking for about 5 minutes. And it was quite difficult because I was looking forward to staying active throughout my pregnancy, but this really stopped me. The pain like made me fearful of doing any yoga or going on any walks. So that part wasn't as great, but because we were kind of in the winter period, the weather wasn't too good. I kind of didn't feel too bad about not exercising and I enjoyed kind of getting the rest, just slumping on the sofa after work on most evenings. So it wasn't all that bad. But yeah, that was something that I'd never thought about. And I'd heard people say, oh, pelvic girdle pain. And I've never thought how bad the pain was. So I really feel for any women that have gone through it. I did try to manage it proactively by seeing a physio. Probably should have seen one sooner than I did. I'd recommend people see physios if they do have this pelvic girdle pain. And I was recommending some exercises, which I kind of managed to keep up with. And that seemed to help the pain, but I found just resting was the best thing for me. Now, that's the physical health side of things. Mental health wise, I remember in the first trimester, I felt very, very tired, and so tired that I couldn't really do the things I could do before. So the podcast was on hold. I wasn't doing anything apart from going to work and coming home. And I remember the thought crossing my mind at once, thinking like, is this like depression or something? Because I literally just felt so unlike myself and that I couldn't do much. But when I really thought about my kind of how I was feeling, I was still looking forward to seeing friends, making plans. So it was mainly the tiredness that was impacting how I felt day to day, but it wasn't what you would call a depressive episode. I was still eating well. I was still sleeping well. I was looking forward to the future. I was looking forward to the pregnancy. So it was really the tiredness that was kind of getting me, making me feel like I didn't have the motivation. But the motivation was there. I just didn't have the energy to carry anything out. But depression can occur through a pregnancy at any point during the pregnancy. And it's could also happen following pregnancy as well. Now, leading up to the birth, obviously because I work in the field of psychiatry, I am very aware and probably too aware of some of the mental health illnesses that can come about following birth. Obviously, birth is this absolutely amazing experience that women get to go through and birth their baby. However, it can be traumatic. You never know what's going to happen during that time, if there's any complications. And what all women go through, irregardless of what type of birth is a sudden drop in their hormones. And what can happen for some women is that they can be very sensitive to these drop in hormones, and that could cause an array of mental health illnesses. So because I had seen patients and managed patients with perinatal mental health, I was very aware of it. So I had been quite proactive. So I had created a mental health plan, which I shared with my husband. So I explained to him if I became unwell, if I wasn't able to make decisions about my care, where I would want to be cared for, what medication I would want if I was to be medicated, what stuff I wouldn't want. I made myself aware of the ways that we can access help. So what are my local services? If I had to go to the GP, or if I needed kind of a crisis team, what would be my local crisis team? So just trying to just work it out and having that frank conversation with my husband. So he was fully aware of what I would want if I lost the capacity to make decisions. And I know this might sound a little bit extreme, but it's just because I work in the profession and I've seen it, I wouldn't want to just go in blind to that situation. So yes, it might seem overcautious, but that gave me a peace of mind that yes, okay, there is a chance that anyone can become mentally unwell after giving birth. And if that occurs for me, this is how I'd like to be managed. And we also both decided that after the baby came along, we would do regular kind of emotional check-ins with each other. And this was two-way. So I'd ask him how he's feeling. He'd ask me how I'm feeling. And we'd have to do it regularly, almost daily. And I explained to him that I will be very honest with how I'm feeling with you. I will not hide anything from you. So if I do get any worrying thoughts, I will make sure I tell you them and I won't hide them from you because I'm worried about how you'll respond. So we both had that very frank conversation. So if I had thoughts of wanting to end my life or wanting to harm the baby or anything like that, it got to that extreme point, I would communicate that with you. And I think that was important because it just helped us both acknowledge that these things can happen when there is such a big life change happening. And there is, like, obviously it's not just going to come out of the blue and there's going to be kind of a decline in mental health before either of us get to that point. But it was important that we keep these emotional check-ins going and not be afraid to talk about how we're feeling. So be more proactive about it. So we'd had a discussion about that. And actually, I think that has really helped both of us and we've been able to keep up with it. And we've been super open. It's allowed us to be vulnerable with each other, cry when we need to cry without feeling like, oh, I'm going to be a burden on my partner. And they don't need this to worry about. They've got the baby to look after. I need to be strong for them. So that's been really, really helpful. So that was the mental health side of things and how we kind of prepared for it. And then the other part of preparation we did was telling our families what kind of support we want and being very clear with both how much support we want, but also our boundaries that we want to still work out how we're going to do this independently when they step away. So we want help, but we want to be supported rather than them having to do everything for us. And I think we communicated that well because they've been so helpful in supporting us, but also giving us the space and independence. And it's allowed us to really thrive in the postpartum period. Okay, so that was a little bit about my pregnancy, the prep, what happened during that time. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the actual labor and what happened. Now, I know lots of people talk about their birth story and they do vlogs on it, YouTube videos, and I found them actually really helpful, especially the positive ones. Now, again, I've said mine is positive-ish. It's probably how I experienced it afterwards, which is the not so positive part rather than the actual events. So I was 39 weeks and 2 days. Now, because I had high blood pressure, I was booked in for an induction. Now, an induction is when labor is medically kind of started. So they give you some medication to get labor going. So it's induced rather than it happening naturally. And they'd given us the choice of what date we wanted that induction. They didn't want me to go beyond 40 weeks because of my high blood pressure. And I kind of felt, okay, yeah, I don't want to put my body or my baby at risk. So I'm happy to go with that. So I had my date as a Thursday and I would have been, I think, about 39 weeks and 5 days. And so I was kind of planning for that. That was going to be a Thursday. But lucky for me, on Monday morning, so that early hours of Monday morning at 1:30 a.m., my contractions started. And I remember it really clearly because for the 3 weeks prior to that, I was getting a very strong Braxton Hicks. Now, these are what we call like false contractions. And I experienced them as like tightening all in my abdomen. So my womb would go like rock hard. It was a really weird sensation. And I'd get kind of like a very mild, dull back pain, which felt like a period pain, but nothing really to talk about. And it wasn't particularly painful. I actually used to find them quite enjoyable because it made me feel like, ah, the time is nearing. And I really thought that the labor pains would be like a ramped up version of the Braxton Hicks. But oh boy, was I wrong. So when my contractions started at 1:30, I knew they started because they were not like the Braxton Hicks at all. It was a very severe version of a period pain, and I felt them all in my back. At this time, me and my husband, we were sleeping in separate rooms because I just needed about 20 pillows around me to be comfortable. So he'd heard me wake up, so he came and joined me. And every time I had a contraction, I would tell him and he would massage my back. So that's how we kind of semi-slept for the rest of the night. And I was able to be, the pain was controlled by that lovely massage he was giving me. We woke up leisurely, kind of had a nice breakfast. And my plan was always going to be that I wanted to labor as much as possible at home. So we were taking it really easy. I wanted to really get those oxytocin levels going, which is the hormone that keeps labor going. And if you become kind of worried, scared, anxious, it can slow down the progression of labor. So we kind of got through the morning. It was lunchtime. I was really craving penne arrabbiata at this point in my pregnancy. So I made myself a really spicy penne arrabbiata. And I know that anecdotally or old wives' tale, spice is meant to get labor going. So I was like, this is the perfect meal that I want to have. So we had that. And during this time, I was still getting contractions, but I was able to kind of manage them with breathing techniques that I'd learned in hypnobirthing. Then I managed to squeeze in a nap. We both had a nap because we were both absolutely kind of knackered from the night. We hadn't really slept, which was good, but I was still kind of really worried that it would start slowing down. So I was kind of measuring it and timing it. And the kind of magic number that you want to get to that the midwives tell you about is 3 in 10. So you want to have 3 contractions in a 10 minute period, and they're meant to last, I think, 45 to 60 seconds, something like that. And mine were just never getting to that level. The pain was increasing and getting more intense with kind of every hour, but they were just not getting close enough. I was probably getting 2 in every 10 minutes, or they'd be more spaced out. They wouldn't last long enough. So I was kind of just pacing the living room, doing my breathing techniques and trying to put into place all my hypnobirthing. So I'd done an online hypnobirthing course. Me and Raj had done that together in preparation for the birth. And actually, I found it really, really useful. I used an app called the Freya app, which is created by the lady that's behind Positive Birth Company, which was the hypnobirthing course I did, and I highly recommend. And that app was excellent because it guided me through breathing during the contractions. And then when the contractions weren't happening, there was a guided meditation. And I think the breathing exercises are excellent, but when you're kind of in the contraction, it's very hard to focus your mind. So I had that. And we also had an excellent stack of affirmation cards, again, from the Positive Birth Company. And I'm not being paid to say any of this. And during the contraction, Raj would read out these positive affirmations. And it all sounds a little bit kind of, I don't know, fluffy, but those affirmations really helped me get through those contractions because it was something to concentrate on, and it really put my mind in kind of a positive mindset rather than concentrating on how bad the pain was. Because the pain is there because your body is doing a tremendous amount of work. Your muscles are really contracting to get them into the right position to eventually push the baby out. So of course it is going to be associated with a level of pain. And I know in hypnobirthing you don't use words like pain or contractions, but just for ease, that's the language I'm going to use today. I didn't really kind of call them surges or think of the pain in different ways because actually I just like to address it for what it was. So that was kind of how the labor continued. So we were saying it's probably about, 6 or 7 o'clock. It's getting pretty bad. My mum's called me and I'm like, yep, definitely kind of in early labor. But I was like, mum, don't know how long it's going to last. Maybe it might be till tomorrow, might still stay in this stage. Don't want to kind of get everyone too excited too quickly. So she said, okay, well, I've cooked food. I'm going to bring it over. So she came over. By the time she'd come over, I was like, I have zero appetite. I can't eat. I've had a really good breakfast and lunch. I can't be eating anything. My husband ate, and I'm really glad he did because that's the last meal that he had until we went for the hospital. And she brought a few other bits for us. And she was like, just take this if you end up going to the hospital. And while she was here kind of doing the food, sorting a few things around the house for us. So she took one look at me and her words were, Raj, you need to get her to the hospital or that baby's going to come out in the toilet. Because she saw while I was here, I was constantly going for a wee. And I was like, I don't know, it just feels like there's a lot of pressure down there. I just keep feeling like I need to go. My mom was like, you guys need to go immediately. And we were like, no, mom. Like, they told us 3 in 10. If we go now, we're just going to be sent back. And then she just looked at me like, I know. Had 3 children, you do not look like you are going to last much longer, so you need to go in. So I kind of thought, oh, all right, it's just still want to keep longing out as much as possible. Don't want to go to hospital and suddenly my contractions slowed down. So what we decided was we'll just try keep like kind of going for a little bit longer. But actually within the next half hour, the pain got so intense for me, I just broke down in tears and I said, Raj, I really can't. I think I've kind of reached my limit of how bad it is now. I think we need to go in. So we called triage, which is what you have to do before you go in. You can't just rock up to kind of get permission, I guess, from them to if it's time for us to come in. And we said, okay, look, the pain's unbearable. Can we come in just to see how we're getting on? And they weren't kind of too sure about it, but they said, yeah, come along, that's fine. So we had our bags packed. Luckily, everything was ready. Obviously, I was 39 weeks. And we got in the car and we went, got there and realized we'd forgotten birth notes. But luckily, the midwife was like, don't worry about that. As long as you've had a chat about what you want, you can just let us know along the way. And we had a very kind of long, lengthy discussion about exactly what our preferences were. And we'd written them down. But we'd actually been very flexible about it as well. So just on a side note, when we created our birth plan, we thought about each different scenario that we could have. So a vaginal delivery, a C-section or emergency C-section, instrumental delivery. It's kind of gone through all the different things that could happen, induction, and what we would like in each scenario if it was possible. So if it wasn't an emergency, there was time, these were the things that we wanted. And again, that helped me get a little bit of control of the situation. But I also was very realistic with myself. And every step of the way, I told myself, this is what I would have if it was ideal conditions. But obviously what I would like ultimately is the health and safety of my baby and myself. So if it can't be done, I understand that. But all of kind of what I wanted was around making it a kind of the most natural experience as possible in line with my body and least intervention possible as well. So back to the story. So at that point, we go to the hospital and I am waiting in the waiting room, which seems like an hour, but actually it was only like 10 minutes and we were seen. They looked at my records. They knew about the blood pressure. So I think they were more concerned about my blood pressure and making sure that was okay. And obviously because I was in pain, it was a little bit on the high side, but I was all right otherwise. At that point, I'd just taken 2 paracetamol since 1:30 in the morning. Because actually the hypnobirthing had been working really, really well for me until that point where I broke down in tears at home and said, listen, I've got to go in. So I got examined. And I was worried that they were going to examine me and it was going to be like 1 or 2 centimeters and they were going to send me home. But to my surprise, it turned out I was 7 centimeters dilated. That would explain why I was in so much pain kind of leading up to coming into hospital. So we were both absolutely relieved. We were like smiling from ear to ear. So glad that we had got this far, managed to do most of the labouring at home. And now they were happy for me to go straight to the labour ward, assign me my midwife that would kind of support me for the rest of the labour. And actually things started progressing quite quickly after that point. So once we got in to the delivery room, which was actually really lovely, I had my heart set on kind of a midwife led unit and I was worried about how clinical the labour ward would be, but actually it was fine. And we'd already kind of brought stuff with us to make the environment exactly how I wanted it to be, to help labour to continue progressing, to keep me calm, keep me relaxed. So we had this really lovely light projector, so that put all these beautiful stars across the walls and the ceilings. We had dim lighting as much as possible. I was hooked up to monitoring. However, I explained to the midwife that I wanted to be kind of mobile throughout, changing positions as I wanted to, and she was very, very accommodating. There was kind of no eyebrows raised or no like, no, you have to do it this way. She was absolutely great. And actually, from the start to beginning, she ensured that she explained everything she was doing, gave me lots of options, and actually allowed me to lead the way. And she was really there supporting me. And kind of when I spoke to Raj about it afterwards, when we reflected on how good she had been, it really felt like a knowledgeable friend was taking us through and supporting us through the labour process, rather than someone telling us what to do and forcing us to do something because they were the expert. But actually, she let me be the expert with how I was feeling, how my body was feeling, what the contractions were like, and let me kind of be in charge of how things went, what position I wanted to be in. She was very, very accommodating, because I'd be like, nope, this is not feeling right. Can I move to this position? Can you move the bed for me, please? And nothing was too much. She really did bend over backwards to make me feel comfortable, make me feel safe, and listen to everything that I had to say. And I think that had a massive impact on how I felt during that whole process. I felt very much listened to, safe, supported, in control as much as possible, and it led for a much more positive experience. And I was very, very grateful for her to be there with me. The kind of other things, so whilst we were planning about how we want labour to go, they urge you to think about the five senses. So this was something that we covered in the NCT course that we did when we were preparing for the birth. And I'd done some reading as well. And they said, just trying to think about the five senses and what you want it to be like. So I had the light projector. I had a bottle of lavender oil, which Raj would kind of waft under my nose every time a contraction would come on. I was getting increasingly warm. I felt like I was sweating. So we had a portable fan, which was helping. So I had the sight, the smell, the temperature. For sound, I had my labor playlist, and I'd listened to this playlist from about when I was like from first trimester, and I would listen to the same playlist on the way to work and on the way back. So it was kind of like a sound that my baby was very much used to. And I remember he used to kind of move a little bit more every time I used to play it. And so I had this calming music. It was predictable. I knew what it was. So those were kind of us trying to work with the senses. And I had Raj reading affirmations to me as well. He was there on hand with a bottle of water to keep me hydrated, kept offering me snacks. So we tried to make the environment as kind of suited as best as possible to allow labor to continue progressing and keep my kind of keep me calm and allow me to really work with my body with the least amount of distractions. And that really helped. I remember telling Raj afterwards, I was like, you were like the most incredible birth partner I could have asked for. Obviously, what led to that was all the conversations that we'd had before and the prep we had done before to kind of decide how we wanted things to go. We had written a birth plan, but we had forgotten it. And I kind of mentioned to the midwife, like, we're really sorry, we've forgotten the birth plan at home. They didn't have a copy of our birth plan. But actually, for both of us just to know exactly what we wanted, that was more than enough, because we could keep relaying that. More importantly, it was important that Raj knew all the preferences. So even if I wasn't able to kind of communicate, then he could keep kind of advocating for me. So that was really, really useful. And another little funny thing, kind of when we were, I mean, when me and Raj were talking about the birth afterwards, it's funny because my recollection of events are slightly different to his. So I remember at certain points of the labor, like Raj was reading out the affirmations to me, and they were actually annoying me. So they were really, really helpful up to a certain point. And then I did not want to hear anything positive. Like the affirmation, some of the affirmations were along the lines are, the contractions can't be stronger than you, as the contractions are you. And at that moment, the pain was so bad, I just thought, what is this BS? And I remember just telling him what I thought I did was just saying, no, don't want them anymore. But actually what I did do was knock the cards, all the affirmation cards, out of his hands. So obviously I profusely apologized in hindsight, saying, I'm really sorry if I was rude to you in labor. I thought that I just said, no, I don't want them. And another time when he'd kind of offered me coconut water, because I was really finding that refreshing in the last few days leading up to the pregnancy, and even then I didn't want that, knocked that right out of his hand as well. So just a little warning, ladies, that if you are a kind of first-time mom's going to go into labour, there are parts of you that will emerge that are not in keeping with your character usually, and I will blame kind of the intense amount of pain that you're in. And what I was trying to say was conveyed in a much more, let's say, aggressive manner than I had intended for it to be. So kind of just back to how things were progressing. So basically, as soon as I was taken to my room, I was hooked up to the monitoring. I was still trying to walk around as much as I could. And I had this intense urge that I just needed to go for a wee. So I was like, okay, Raj, come with me. I don't feel like I can go alone. You can still help me, kind of help me through the contractions, because they were still coming very fast, very close together, very intense. And actually, when I got to the bathroom, I suddenly had a urge to push, let out the most feral scream, like noises and groans were coming out of me that I had never heard, Raj had never heard, surprised both of us. And at that point, my waters broke. And then we kind of walked back to the delivery room, and midwife was like, okay, well, you're fully dilated now, part of your waters have broken, so when you get the urge to push, now you just need to push. So I think this was probably around about 10:30, 11 o'clock maybe. And yeah, so things started moving very quickly. And at that point, I thought, okay, well, baby's going to be here any moment. Little did I know that that part of the pushing part would actually take me up till 12:45. And I think at this point, I was just feeling extremely tired. I was finding it really hard to coordinate pushing and trying to understand my body. And when I felt that urge, trying to go with it, I felt it was all very uncoordinated and I couldn't sustain the pushing. I was also trying to really put into practice what I'd learned with the hypnobirthing, which is a technique where you breathe your baby down. And it actually been a skill that I had practiced quite a lot. But when it got to that time, I found it really, really difficult. So this is again some advice that everything that you practice, whether it's hypnobirthing or any other techniques, when you actually get into labor, it can sometimes be a slightly different story. And you may have to change your plan. I was kind of very fixated on breathing down my baby. I wanted to be in certain positions, kind of like a squat or on all fours, just to help baby come out more easily. However, I continued with this technique for almost 2 hours and there was no success with it. And then I got to a point where I was literally telling the midwife, just do what you need to, please, just give me a hand. If you can see baby's head, just pull him out, please. I was getting very, very desperate at this point because I was tiring and I just wanted baby out, basically. I didn't think that I could keep pushing. I even asked about an epidural at one point, and it wasn't even the pain. I just wanted something else to keep it going. I remember telling Raj, and it all is a little bit hazy as I get further away from the birth, parts of it become hazy. But I remember saying that actually the pushing part was way easier, and I would take the pushing part any day over the contractions because that part was significantly less painful for me anyway. Obviously everyone's experiences are different. So at that point I'm like, just you need to do what you need to do, instrumental delivery, get the ventus, get the forceps, do whatever. And the midwife just said, well, I've had a discussion with the reg and what we need to do is get you into a lithotomy position, which is kind of you lie flat and you have your legs up in stirrups. And she goes, I really want you to like push down. And this was something that I was very much against. So they tell you when to push and you kind of keep your mouth closed, chin down, and you just push against with your breath held. And that's really not what I wanted to do. I wanted to breathe down my baby like I had learned in hypnobirthing. So I was kind of resisting that for quite a while. And then she said, okay, well, if you want to progress to an instrumental delivery, we really need to try this position. And if it doesn't work, then we can see what other options you have. So I was like, okay, fine. Do you know what? I just need to give it a go. That didn't work. So they said, okay, well, the next step before we think about a ventus or a forceps, so that's called an instrumental delivery, where they help the baby out with either putting a suction cap on their head or using something called forceps, which are kind of like an instrument to help pull baby out. They said, we can consider doing an episiotomy, which is a small cut that is made to help the baby come out. And at this point, I was taking anything. I said, yep, go for it. So we had the most loveliest registrar come in. So a registrar is still a junior doctor in training, but she seemed quite senior and she was absolutely excellent. She explained the whole procedure to me, got my consent, talked to me whilst she was doing every part. So numbing the area, then making the cut. And actually it just required that small cut and one push and baby came out at 0046 on the Tuesday. So it was almost 24 hours since my first contraction started that our beautiful baby boy was born. And he was immediately put onto my chest so we could have skin to skin whilst I waited for the placenta to come out. So actually the placenta coming out was such a strange feeling. I could feel it coming away and it kind of just like literally, the best way to explain it is like plopping out my vagina. It was a very, very weird, strange feeling, but I could feel that kind of like a relief, that the heaviness had gone from that area. And then after that, Raj had the opportunity to cut the cord, so he did that as well, which was something that we'd discussed before. So all the things that we had discussed in our birth plan, we were able to do. Obviously, it was easy for us because there was no complications during our labor. So baby's heart rate was fine throughout. I was doing fine throughout, which meant that any of the procedures, so even the episiotomy that I had to have done, the cut, it wasn't kind of done in a rushed or an emergency way. It was kind of like, okay, well, this is the next thing that we can consider and that's what we're going to go for. So it did mean that we were able to follow a lot of our birth plan as we had wanted it to go. We had discussed what we'd want in other situations, but I think when it becomes a little bit more of an emergency, a little more time critical, it can be difficult for you to explain to people, oh, could I have this music? Could I have this? I wanted this. So we were lucky enough that we could have things the way we wanted. And that allowed me to have a little bit more kind of be at peace that I was still in control of how the birth was going. So our baby boy had skin to skin. The midwife helped him latch on so he could have his first kind of breastfeeding session. And they stitched me up. And it was actually like, I was just feeling, had that kind of surge of just absolute happiness that they talk about. And it was just really beautiful. We were both just soaking in every kind of bit of our baby boy, quickly messaging our family and letting them know. And it was actually like ages until someone actually kind of woke up and messaged us back, because it was so kind of late at night that he was born. But it was just so, so lovely. Oh, another thing that my husband did is when we got into the delivery room, which was just so sweet, he quickly texted my family and my friends to say, just to update them, to say, come on, she's 7 centimeters. She just needs that little bit more encouragement to keep going. Send some positive voice notes or messages. So they sent through some lovely messages, which he read out to me, which were really encouraging and helpful as well. So yeah, so our baby boy was born. I'd had some blood loss when I had the cut, so just under 500 mils, but my hemoglobin had been quite low leading up to the pregnancy as well. So that was one of the other things that they had to keep an eye on. But the blood loss wasn't large enough to have a blood transfusion or anything like that. But I remember straight after the birth, after I'd had something to eat and it was time for us to be kind of moved to the other ward, the open ward, I was feeling extremely dizzy, lightheaded. And as a child, I used to faint a lot. So I knew exactly what that feeling felt like, where my hearing would go, my eyes would start getting fuzzy and I could just feel it. And I had a fainting episode, but they just explained, you know what, you've just been through birth, you've lost some blood, so it's quite normal to feel like that. So when you think that the worst is over, you can still have lots of after effects. And actually, although there was no actual trauma, yes, I'd had a cut, but that had been dealt with some medication. I'd had some strong pain medication to help that heal. So I was actually feeling okay in myself, physically and mentally. Of course, I was very sleep deprived because it'd kind of been 24 hours of no sleep. And then it was time for Raj to leave at about 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning, and he was going to go home, have a quick nap, bring a few things in and come straight back in time for the ward round in the morning. And they said if everything was looking okay, they were actually happy for us to be discharged. which I was really glad about. I was feeling kind of too weak to have a shower or anything, so I had a sponge bath, made myself feel a bit fresh, but really I just wanted to get home, be in my own bed. On the ward, it was absolutely boiling. That's what you get with NHS sites. The radiators are either on or off, and because I think we were still in the kind of winter-ish period, the radiators were on and it was absolutely boiling. I slept a little bit in the morning, but I was really hyper aware that he needed to be fed and he was going to have some more bloods done. So I kind of set an alarm on my phone for 5 o'clock. So I probably had about an hour's sleep before I was up again and had him on my chest, was feeding him. He had some blood tests done and then just kind of really stayed awake, staring at his beautiful little face, waiting for the ward round to happen. Had the classic tea and toast in the morning, which tasted amazing. And then I was just waiting for my husband to come back in and everything was fine. He'd been checked over. I had my bloods done and they weren't concerned. I was still feeling extremely weak at this point. I remember even going to the bathroom, kind of walking there. I felt like I had zero energy. Like my whole body was shaking. I had to take like one step really slowly at a time. I was holding onto the wall to kind of support myself. Like bending down on the toilet, I was just finding it too hard. It felt like all my muscles were in a state of shock. And I thought, okay, that's just normal. This happens post-birth. Your body's been through a lot. And I remember using every single muscle in my body to try to push him out towards the end. So I thought, you know what, you've just exerted yourself a lot. You just need some time and you'll start feeling better. So there's no concerns from any of the staff. They said, yeah, pain is normal, which I'd kind of expected as well. And they were happy for us to go home. So we were able to go home on that day. So he was born at 1:45 in the morning on Tuesday, and we were able to go home by 5 p.m. There were kind of bed pressures and a shortage of beds, so they were quite keen to get people moving, but at the same time, we didn't feel like we were rushed out there. We were so happy to be going home to our family and to the comfort of our homes. So we left that day with our beautiful bundle of joy and got home, and I'd already asked my family to be home when we got there. I wanted them to see him. I didn't want to be alone at home, and we'd get that little bit of help before we had our first night together. So it was lovely. I got home. The pain was still there. I was feeling extremely weak still. And in the first few days, maybe weeks after you give birth, when you're breastfeeding, your uterus also contracts. And I was finding that actually really difficult. So every time I had that contraction, when he was breastfeeding and my uterus contracted, I would have this almost flashback, but like a visceral flashback. So it was my body felt like it was going back to the worst contractions I had, and it would make my whole body kind of freeze up. And I'd want to almost start crying because I'd just go back to that moment when the contractions were really bad before I was in hospital, able to have the gas and air. So I found that quite difficult. So that was the kind of jumping to a few days after giving birth. And something else was also happening, which I later had time to think about and reflect on. So I'd had a vaginal birth, which had been quite straightforward. Yes, your body is in pain and needs time to recover. But the pain that I was experiencing, I had all over body pain, seemed a bit out of proportion to having a vaginal birth. And then I remember on the day after I gave birth, I said to Raj, I'm in so much pain, and I'm particularly in pain around my stomach. I almost feel like I've had a C-section. And he just looked at me and said, babe, you shouldn't be in pain around there. And I said, I don't know why, but I really feel like I need to be careful of a scar, like where you would get a scar if you've had a C-section. And it was just so random. And like, I had no cuts or anything on my abdomen because I had a pure vaginal delivery. And I just couldn't get my head around it. And it actually made me feel really upset as well. And I was really careful with walking. I actually couldn't hold my baby standing up, and I couldn't do the stairs with him. I had to be sitting down if I was holding him. And even when I was sitting down, I was really kind of worried about putting him over my tummy. Again, as if I had a scar there. And it was a very unusual kind of sensation. Even when I was doing the stairs for the first 2 days, I had to actually crawl up the stairs because I felt really weak and an absolute pain. Raj had to supervise me when I had a shower because I just felt too weak to do it. And all of this just, I Googled it and it did seem out of proportion to the birth that I had. And I just couldn't work out. And it was really upsetting me, the pain that I was having. So then I tried to speak to Raj about it. I still wasn't sure if this was normal or if I should just give my body some time. And he said, don't worry, babe, just give it some time. It will get better. And I decided to speak to my dad. For those of you who have listened to previous podcasts or you've listened to the podcast I did with my dad, you'll know a little bit about him. So he does a lot of mind-body work. So he helps people with physical illness, with mental illness. When they aren't able to help themselves going down the conventional route, he will step in to see what the root cause is. And usually there is something that happens to someone in a traumatic way, and then that experience is kind of manifests as a physical illness. So I thought, okay, do you know what? I should just speak to my dad about this. And my parents were coming to our house every day. And I think just said to my dad, I said, Dad, this pain is unbearable. I don't know what's happening. And I broke down crying. And he helped me make sense of the situation. And what it brought to the forefront of my mind was actually I was carrying a lot of guilt for having a vaginal delivery. So my sister had given birth 6 months ago and she had had a beautiful, smooth pregnancy after going through IVF. But her birth had ended in an emergency C-section and it'd been very traumatic for her in terms of the choices that she was and she wasn't given and how she felt after. And she hadn't been given kind of the highest level of care that she should have during the labour, which ultimately led to a C-section and prolonged recovery after that. And what I had actually done is kind of carried that with me, carried her pain with me, because we were me and my sister, so I've got an older sister and a young sister, we are very, very close. We always have been. And it hurt us both a lot to see her go through the pain that she did with her C-section, but she's someone that just is very practical and will take whatever life throws at her and turns it into a positive situation, just gets on with it. She's very independent. But actually, I had seen how difficult it had been for her and seen her how she'd carried that with her the months after she had given birth. And we'd talked about it and she'd kind of said like, yeah, this is how you can prepare for it. I don't want you to go through what I did. And that's kind of just been our relationship throughout our lives, where the older sister experiences everything so that she can come back and give you notes and tell you how to do it better and how not to do it and what to be wary of. And she'd done the same in this situation. And actually it allowed me, I think, to have the most beautiful vaginal birth. But what it came with was that guilt of, why couldn't she have this? Or why didn't I also have a C-section so I could join her in that pain? And immediately as I recognized where that pain came from, the pain went away. Like in an instant, I was suddenly able to walk the stairs. I was able to hold my body up straight. I wasn't in pain. I was able to hold my baby standing up. And it all came from me acknowledging the guilt that I was carrying with me and just letting it go. So if we wanted to give that a name or a label or a diagnosis, it's called somatoform pain disorder, or it could be called a conversion disorder, which is where some kind of trauma in your mind manifests as a physical illness. Only when you start acknowledging the root cause, which is where the trauma, and start working through that, then you can work through the physical part of the illness as well. And that's what I was able to do. And lucky for me, I have someone like my dad who was able to help me work through these things. I am quite self-aware myself, but I wasn't able to get to the root cause of it on my own. So he was able to help guide me through it. So it meant that this pain that I was experiencing and the weakness I was experiencing was not prolonged. And I was able to then properly start my postpartum journey and kind of be in my best possible shape and form in doing so and give everything to my baby. And it allowed me to have an open conversation with my sister as well, tell her how I'd be feeling. And it was funny because after I saw her, after I'd had this discussion with my dad and all my pain had gone away, I'd been feeling well. When I saw her, the pain came back again, just temporarily. And I had to remind myself, you do not have to carry any guilt. Everyone has their own path. There are other ways that you can support your sister. You don't have to join her in the pain that she went through to make her feel less alone. There are other ways that you can support each other. So it was, again, just how strong our minds are. It reminded me, not that I needed a reminding, but it was that strong reminder of how something in your mind can manifest in your body. And until you address the root cause, it will stay with you. And you can turn it on and off like that once you become aware of it. So once that had kind of passed, like I said, I was able to continue with my journey, but it wasn't the most straightforward journey going on as well. So again, just to kind of summarize, although if you saw my birth story on paper, that sounds like a perfect story. And the reason that I wanted to share my experience was, again, to share that you can have the most perfect birth, but it isn't just about the physical things that happen in birth that lead to your experience. It will be all the emotions that you come into that place with, all the experiences you've had before, the stories you've heard about birth before, whether they're your family's friends, something you've read about, something you've watched on TV, all of those things you bring into the delivery room, all the preparation that you've done, the expectations you have, even having too high expectations of how easy the birth is going to be, can be a downfall sometimes. Or thinking that it's going to be really bad, you may make it feel worse than it is. Your mother's experiences, the other female influences in your life and how it's been, how birth is looked at in your culture. So it just really shows that, yes, the trauma that happens to a woman when she gives birth can be the physical traumatic part of how the care happens, but there's so many other parts that can contribute to how a woman experiences her birth as well. And that, so the reason that I am kind of saying that is to make people feel seen. Because I remember, like, even my really good friend who is an obstetrician, she's still in her training, and she was really supportive throughout the pregnancy, and she worked at the unit where I gave birth, and even everyone was commending me on, like, well, you literally had, like, the best birth ever. But as I said, on paper it can look fine, but you can still have some kind of difficulties, whether it's emotional, whether it's pain, whether it's bonding, whether it's anxiety, feeling low in mood, not feeling yourself. There are so many things that can happen. And then the other thing I want to say is, it's not, you don't have to have a diagnosed mental illness to validate not feeling well after you give birth, not feeling yourself. It is like a roller coaster where you are feeling absolutely amazing and then can feel really rubbish. And all these things are valid emotions. And just because your birth was perfect on paper does not mean that your recovery and postpartum periods need to be perfect. There will be highs and lows, and that is absolutely normal. And the way that I've kind of dealt with it is to take each day as it comes, not have expectations of what sleep will be like, what the feeding will be like, and if there's problems, being very solution focused to see, okay, what's going to get me through this day, and looking for as much support. So that was a summary about the birth and how that went. Now, after birth was a bit of a roller coaster as well for us, for me anyway. And so baby was born, all doing well. I remember when, whilst I was feeding him in hospital, my nipples were starting to get sore, and I thought, I've been told breastfeeding should not be painful. So I kind of asked the midwife that came to see me, like, is his latch okay? My nipples are feeling a bit sore. Is everything all right? Am I doing it correctly? And they all kind of took like a 2-second glance at him and me and his position. And they were like, yeah, he looks fine. Nothing to worry about. And actually, the lack of breastfeeding support was so shocking to me. I thought that I would have someone that would come and show me exactly how to position him, the different positions I could do, how to get me comfortable, but I literally had none of that. I'm not sure if that was because how quickly we were discharged. I asked for someone to come and see me, but by the time, because we were being discharged that day, I'm not sure if that was the reason we didn't have anyone come to us, but it was very, very limited in what kind of breastfeeding support you have. But I thought, it's fine. I've got my mum, I've got my sister, they can support me. They're experts. My sister had an excellent breastfeeding journey. She was so good at it. She's just an absolute pro, just kind of is breastfeeding on demand. So naturally, she looked like she'd been doing it all her life. So I was like, it's fine. I'm going home to her. And I told her, look, I've got sore nipples, sort me out. So she, when I got home, she had these excellent silver cups to put on my nipples, which felt like absolute heaven after they'd been sore for a day, and some nipple balm, which really, really helped me. But what happened over the next few days is they continued to be sore, Every time my baby cried for a feed, I was dreading the feed. They started getting misshapen, bleeding. At one point, it looked like there was pus coming out, and actually my baby boy didn't actually want to even go on the boob because he could like, it looked like he was tasting it and he didn't like it. And it was getting really, really difficult. And I thought to myself, well, I don't know how I'm going to carry on, but I want to breastfeed so badly. This is what I want to do. So I said, look, this is the only way my baby is getting food and nutrition. I have to carry on. So I continued through the pain. I had lots of things to help me. So I have this ice roller, which I brought once when I was on a holiday in Spain. And you put it in your freezer and it's like a roller. And you use it when the weather's hot to keep you cool. So I was using this. With every breastfeed, I would have to do the roller on my breasts to kind of distract me from the pain. At this time, he also got diagnosed with neonatal jaundice. So this can be quite common in babies, and they had to do some blood tests. Unfortunately, the day after he was born, there was lots of snow. So midwives were meant to come to our house to do his blood test, but that wasn't possible. So we had to go out in the snow with our 2-day-old baby to get the blood test done. We were absolutely worried because we thought we might get stuck in the snow. But at the same time, we were like, he needs to get this blood test done because if it's too high, he needs to get admitted to hospital to have something called phototherapy. Lucky for us, every blood test showed that his jaundice was improving, so we didn't need to have the phototherapy, we didn't need to go into hospital. But they kept saying, well, the way for his jaundice to improve is by feeding him. So you just have to keep feeding. And I just thought, oh my God, how am I going to do this? But at the same time, I thought, I'm his mom, and I'm the only person that can help him in this situation, so I just have to keep going. And whilst all this was happening, I was kind of speaking to my mom. I was like, mom, it's really painful. She goes, that's normal. It was painful for me initially, then it'll get better. Mother-in-law said the same thing. They said, it's still early days. Just keep going. See how you get on. So I keep going. I think that's fine. This is normal. It will get better, but it's not getting better at all. Night feeds I'm finding particularly difficult because I'm really sleepy. I'm sleep deprived. I have to wake up, got this crying baby, and he needs a feed. I'm going to be in absolute agony. It was, looking back, I don't know how I did it, basically. But I think the pain of labor kind of primed me because it wasn't as bad as labor, but it was getting close to. If labor was a 10 out of 10, this pain was an 8 out of 10. So it's pretty excruciating. And the pain, if I try to describe it, what it was like is if you can remember cartoons when they used to have like a bear trap, like the one that clamps onto a bear's foot. It felt like a mini one of those was in my baby's mouth. And every time he was sucking on my breast, it felt like it was chomping down on my nipple. That's literally the pain that I was feeling. It was very, very difficult. And there was nothing I could do about it, basically, apart from trying to distract myself whilst he was feeding. And during that time, I had all my friends kind of messaging me, being very supportive. I'm one of the first out of my friendship groups to have a baby. So kind of, it was all very new to them as well. But I did have my husband's cousin's wife who had just given birth recently, and one of my really good friends from uni, his wife as well, had given birth. And they were both, because they were new moms, they were checking in on me and being like, how's it going? How are you doing? And they were being like super, super supportive and being like, you're doing amazing, even though they had no idea how I was doing. But I literally just got so pumped from getting messages from them saying I was doing well. And they were like, how's your breastfeeding going? And I told them, and both separately, I was like, it's good, but it's very, very painful. My nipples feel like they're going to fall off. And both of them told me, well, one of them said, I had the same exact thing. And it turned out that our baby had a tongue tie, so you might want to get this checked out. Now, as a doctor who has been to med school and is supposed to know everything about everything related to health, I did not know about tongue tie. So I knew what a tongue tie is. It's like when there is an extra piece of kind of skin or attachment between the tongue and the bottom of the mouth, which means that the tongue's movement is a bit restricted. But I thought if there's a tongue tie, I'd definitely be able to see it. And I looked inside my baby's mouth. It was fine. He'd been examined by other midwives. He was fine. No one picked up on anything. So I thought, oh, it can't be that. But what my friend was explaining was exactly the symptoms I was having. And she said, you just need to get him checked out by an expert, by someone that does tongue ties. And if it is, they will just make a small cut and he will be able to move his tongue better, and it will slowly get better. At this point, it had only, I think we were like day 5 post-birth, but I was in absolute agony. So every day I was kind of finding like, okay, what can I do to make this better? And I'd tried to use all the techniques of using the ice, cooling therapy, all of that, silver cups on my nipples in between feeds, but nothing had really worked. So what I thought is, okay, when we did the NCT course, there was a breastfeeding counsellor that came and did sessions. She said, any problems, you can drop me a text and I can support you. And I thought, you know what, I don't, text or phone call is not going to cut it. I need her to come to my house. And she was kind enough to be able to offer me an appointment for the next day. So I messaged her on Saturday. She said, I can come by on Sunday. I said, that's perfect. Thank you so much. And this is what kind of kept me going Friday and Saturday. And on the Saturday, we had all our family around because there's a kind of a ceremony that we do when our baby turns 6. So I had to kind of put a brave face on while I was feeding him throughout. And I just really wanted to enjoy the day. And actually, I was able to because I had a really big distraction, but the pain was still very much there. So then 7 days, kind of that next day after he was, the next day after that religious ceremony, I got seen by the lovely Justine, who came and saw. She said, your positioning's fine, you're doing really well, but I can see that your nipples look absolutely damaged. There's lots of damage there, and it could be a tongue tie. So she gave us some really good contacts, and Raj booked an appointment for the next day straight away to see a tongue tie specialist. So I was feeling like, okay, as long as the only thing that was getting me through kind of every 12 or 24 hours of feeding was to know, okay, there may be a solution to this pain. So I was able to, again, feed him through the day, feed him through the night, kind of just keep going with it because I knew I had this appointment. The appointment was a whole hour journey away, but I thought, do you know what? I don't care. We will do whatever we need to. So we took our little boy, put him in the car seat, and he did really well. We're doing an hour journey. We had to do this thing where we had to not feed him 2 hours before. So we had a little bit of crying on the way as well, but we managed to get there. We saw an amazing lady who is a midwife and then had trained as something called a lactation consultant. And I would tell first-time moms that if you have any problems with breastfeeding, get in touch with a lactation consultant. They are really valuable experts in breastfeeding. They have to go through a lot of training to become a lactation consultant. For that reason, they are expensive, but they are incredible. So we saw her, she took a history, then she did the assessment, made sure we were involved every step of the way. And they do something called a Hazel Baker assessment. And the baby's tongue is assessed on how it looks and how it functions out of a score of 14. And if their score is below 11, then they will consider cutting. And our little boy's score was 6 out of 14. So when I saw her do the exercises with him, it just made it so clear why I was getting so much pain, because my poor boy wasn't able to latch on. He wasn't able to get enough milk in, and therefore it was leading to painful, prolonged feeding and repeated free feeding as well. So because it was 6 out of 14, he got it cut. And then she kind of said, as soon as, for most people, when the procedure is done and you feed, you notice difference straight away. So I was really excited for this. I was like, oh, pain-free feeding is here. So he had the procedure done. Then I put him back on the boob and the pain was there just as much as it was before. It literally felt no different. And I just felt so crushed and so disheartened. But she said, don't worry. Look, sometimes it takes some time for the baby to learn how to use the tongue again, because it's been in this restricted position since his tongue has developed in utero. So this isn't like 6 days of not being able to use the tongue. He'd been using this tongue in an improper way since he was in the womb. So I thought, okay, be patient. You've got this far. Whatever was going wrong, we've got it fixed. Now it can only go up from them. But I remember, and she showed me, like, she kind of said, oh, how are you holding him? And the position I was holding him in, she kind of tore it apart and corrected me massively. And in that moment, I felt like, oh my God, I'd been doing it all wrong. I'm a bad mom. I should have known how to position him better and all these things. And I felt quite disheartened after that appointment, surprisingly, even though we'd had this procedure done, which was going to help our baby and help my breastfeeding journey. So we come home and I'm feeling kind of the lowest I'd ever felt since the birth. I think it was a combination of everything that had happened up till then, my hormones being all over the place, because I remember being like on an absolute high the few days before, like feeling on top of the world, even though I had the pain. And I think it all just came crashing down that day with the hormones. And it was probably kind of a touch of baby blues. And I remember that evening when my family left, I just like broke down in tears. My husband saying, look, I just don't know what's going on. I just feel really rubbish. I'm not sure how I'm going to get through the night. And then even when I held my baby, I had this very unusual feeling where he didn't feel like he was mine. And I felt zero I felt zero emotion towards him. No love, not even any negative emotions. It was just nothing at all. And it really scared me that I felt that way. And because of the discussions me and my husband had before birth, I was very open with it. And I said, Raj, this is how I feel. He's in my arms, but I feel nothing. Like, this could be anyone's baby. He doesn't feel like he's mine. And I feel really rubbish. I don't know how I'm going to continue looking after him throughout the night. Like, I'm a bit worried. And he goes, doesn't matter. I'm here and we'll support you and we'll just see how things go. We'll just take each day as it comes. And I did some more skin to skin that evening. So I said, come on, let's strip him down, put him on your bare chest and just feed him as you usually do. And let's see how things go. The pain was still there, like as bad as it had been. So nothing was improving from that point of view. And I think I'd still felt really crappy from that appointment because how I'd been holding him, that positioning had been, she told me to do it totally differently. I just felt, what's going on? So luckily when I woke up in the morning, that feeling of being disconnected from the baby had gone away, but my breastfeeding pain was still very much there. I kind of felt like, oh, like the thing that was meant to make it better hasn't made it better. What's gonna happen now? So then I kind of got onto Google and I thought, okay, well, what services does my NHS Trust have to support me? And I remember being told about the infant feeding team, so I rang them up. They didn't pick up, but they had an option to leave a voicemail, and I thought, oh, like in the NHS getting an appointment for anything is impossible. I don't know when I'm going to be able to see this infant feeding team, this elusive team, but let me just give it a go. So I left my details and said, listen, I've got really painful feeding, I've had a tongue tie release, but it's not made much difference. Can I see someone? Can I get some support? And I got a call back 2 hours later and from a lovely lady, and she said, I can see you tomorrow afternoon if you can make it. Unfortunately, we don't do home visits, but if you can come to the hospital and I'll see you. And I said, yes, of course I can be there. And again, that was like another appointment that kept me going. And I thought, okay, yes, I'll keep going to that appointment and that'll give me some hope. And it was literally, again, just taking it each day as it came. Because if I tried to think like, oh, I want to keep exclusively breastfeeding until 6 months, like that just seemed way out of reach at that moment in time. So I went along to this appointment and this is where it really turned a corner for me. I had the most amazing supportive midwife that was an expert in breastfeeding and just general infant feeding. And she really was patient, non-judgmental, really compassionate, kind. She watched me as I fed my baby. And then she very kindly and sensitively showed me how I could make some adjustments. And it was literally her making one small adjustment for me where the pain went from an 8 out of 10 to a 0 out of 10. I was in absolute shock that just that small adjustment could make such difference. So I started on one side, on one breast, and then she showed me on the other breast. She showed me some other options and some variations to do as well. She gave me some general tips on how I can like stop him falling asleep on the breast. Everything that I actually hadn't really known before, because the most I'd got in terms of breastfeeding support, and this was probably a little bit of naivety on my side. I just thought, do you know what? I can't really prepare for it. I don't have a baby in front of me before I give birth. Once the baby comes, it will all kind of fall into place and I'll just deal with it then. But the only kind of pre-work I had done regarding the breastfeeding was through the NCT class. There was one session on breastfeeding then, but again we use like baby dolls and it just is not the same as doing it with your own real life baby and kind of trying to navigate a wriggling little cutie and getting them to latch properly and all those things. And so it was here that really, I felt like I'd really turned a corner in my breastfeeding journey. I could see hope. I left that appointment feeling amazing. Then I was like, I just need to keep putting this into practice. And we did well and I was doing really well for a week. And then suddenly I was getting pain with one side and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't get him to latch. So I was like, well, he just needs to feed from one. So I kept feeding on the left side, which was my preferred side. I felt more comfortable just the way that my hands would be positioned. He latched on perfectly. It was pain free. So I continued, but obviously the supply on the other side kept filling up and it was getting quite uncomfortable for me. And then every time I did try to put him on that side, that breast was just so full, it was difficult for him to latch on. So again, I called the team and I was like, is there any way I could get one one more appointment just to kind of see. They were like, no problem, come in tomorrow. Again, they were just so kind in offering me an appointment straight away. And I think that's really important, because with breastfeeding, it only needs to give like 24, 48 hours of not being able to do something well, in which time you might decide, actually, I'm just going to make that switch, because that baby is fully reliant on you as a human to provide them all their food and water and nutrition. And when they're newborn, you're feeding on demand, but you're roughly doing it every 2 hours or more in that time period during the day, and like 3 hours. So you're doing so many feeds, like 8 to 12. I was probably doing a little bit more than that, and that can be normal. So it's a lot of feeds to get through in a 24-hour period when things aren't working for you. And if you do give up, any supply can reduce quite quickly as well. So it can be hard to get back to it. And that's what my main concern was. So I saw this amazing midwife, and it was really a confidence thing. When she was there, I just felt much more calmer. I felt like she was giving me the right support. And my baby boy latched on perfectly, and it was brilliant. So I kind of left that appointment thinking, do you know what? If I do have another hurdle with this breastfeeding journey, it's fine. I just need to go back to basics, go back to the initial techniques that she's taught me, and it will all fall into place. And I thought, you know, I can't keep coming back to her when I have a small problem. There was almost like I felt guilty, because I started asking her like, oh, how many people access this service? Like, are you really busy? Because I just felt like for me to be offered an appointment so soon, like, maybe people just don't know that they can ask for the help and that they're actually quite quiet. But then she went on to tell me how busy their service is. But generally, they're looking at people that are moms that are in the hospital with their babies, and they're not putting on weight, or they're in the NICU, which is the neonatal intensive care unit, and they're helping them with their feeding. So they're actually helping the tip of the iceberg. So someone like me with sore nipples post a tongue tie release is really not their set of moms that they're helping. So that's when I realized that actually this midwife was actually being really kind and coming out of her way to offer me an appointment. And she was telling me how very often she will be working like beyond her hours, like 2 or 3 hours beyond, because she just really wants to help these women. And you could see how passionate she was about the job. So that kind of made me feel, do you know what, come on, I can't be taking up this lovely midwife's time. I need to like think about what resources I have. So I started following loads of Instagram accounts by lactation consultants. So they are women that have trained up quite intensively for several years, been very hard exams to become a lactation consultant. They were giving free advice on the internet, and I used to scroll through these videos every night. So it would kind of remind me of all the tips and tricks and the techniques that I need to adopt, reassure me that I'm doing the right thing. And every time I did kind of have a little slip up or some difficulty, then I would be able to get back on track myself. I also joined something called the Breastfeeding Network. So this is led by women with lived experience of breastfeeding, and they help other mums on their journey. So I joined a Zoom call, which was really good. And again, it wasn't like these women were giving me new information that I didn't know, but they gave me that confidence and that support to say, do you know what, this happens. In my head, I had thought that once baby latches on, that was it. Baby will just breastfeed as normal. But what I realized was the breastfeeding journey was very up and down. And actually, every time my baby grew a little, his positioning would change and the latch would need to be a little different. I would need to be position myself differently and adapt to his growing body. And it would be like a two-way thing between me and him. And I needed to stay calm. I needed to use the techniques, and I needed to help him to get onto the boob. And actually, as he became better at using his tongue and he became more used to me as well, we both worked really well together in getting there. And at the moment, our journey is still up and down. I will have some days where we have some difficult, painful latches, but I'm able to get back on to kind of correcting my position so it doesn't last too long and I'm not getting those sore nipples. And again, when I was planning this podcast, this was something I really wanted to talk about. I just feel like we just don't talk about breastfeeding enough, or maybe actually I didn't know about it because I wasn't asking new mums the right questions. But now, like, I've got a few friends that are pregnant. That's the one thing that I kind of give them the lowdown on, even if they might have an actually really easy breastfeeding journey. But I just think if you know that things can be hard, if you're in that same position, you know what support to go for. And there's actually a lot of support out there. What I recommend is all new moms to be is just have an idea of what support is out there before they give birth, so that if they do have any problems, they know, okay, I can call this number, I can speak to this person, and then take it from there. Now, the final topic that I wanted to touch on is about support in the postpartum period. Again, I was in a very privileged position that my family lives 15, 20 minutes away. My sister, her husband, and their 6, 7 month old baby, they live 15, 20 minutes away as well. So in the immediate kind of few weeks after I gave birth, my family were coming to the house every day with lunch and dinner. And if my in-laws visited, they would do the same as well. What this meant is that me and Raj could really concentrate on looking after baby. And also when they came, it would give us the opportunity to both have a nap, because those initial days of sleep deprivation is really significant. So it would give me the opportunity, both of us actually, the opportunity to have a nap during the day while they looked after the baby, sorted out things around the house, did the laundry, loaded the dishwasher, kind of gave the place a good clean. So just those kind of little chores that will build up if you don't have support and help. And it also meant that I was eating really healthy, nutritious foods to help with my recovery, and same with my husband. So we were really looking after our mind and body in that time, and they were helping us get the sleep in. The sleep deprivation, I can't stress enough how difficult that is, and that's something that you can't really prepare for. It's going to happen, and the best way to manage it is by having people come around so you can have those naps, and definitely not missing a chance to have a nap, even if it's just one person naps while the other looks after the baby. If you don't have that extended support from family, we were very lucky, and I understand everyone's not in that privileged position to have family nearby or have family at all, to be honest. So we kind of got our sleep in where we could. I think the sleep deprivation is particularly hard because during that time when you go into labor, we went into labor like after midnight, so didn't sleep that night. And then the next night I was actually giving birth to the baby, so no sleep then, hardly any sleep. And then the next night was our first night with baby, and the next night was first night with our baby. So we were both kind of like sleeping but not sleeping and worried, and I'd set alarms for when I need to wake up to feed him. I was just worried that I'd forget, or yeah. It was a roller coaster in those first few days, definitely. And sleep deprivation makes your emotions go all over the place. And that's not just for mums, it's for the dads as well. So it was really important that I kind of checked in with Raj as well. Of course, I'd gone through the physical part of the labor and my hormones were all over the place, but Raj was still there every step of the way with me going through it. And when you do give birth and you're finally a parent, which happens very quickly, of course you're preparing for it through the pregnancy, but a bump is nothing like having the physical baby in front of you at all. And it's going to bring up lots of fears, anxieties, expectations, and these are all going to come from your childhood experiences, the experiences you had of your parents. You might think about how it may have been for your parents during that time and feel some sadness about that. You might worry that you won't be a good enough parent. I know my kind of worries in the first few days was I'm never going to be as good as a mom as my mom, because obviously I'd seen her be a mom to my youngest sister, and that was her third child, so she was an absolute pro, and she was just brilliant with us in terms of making sure the house was clean, we were fed, taking us everywhere. So I just thought, wow, like, she must have just been a natural at it. And will I be a natural at it? Did I have the skills to be an amazing mom like she had? So all these doubts and fears and anxieties creep in, and they're made worse by the sleep deprivation. So you don't really have a chance to kind of be rational about it. So yes, there were definitely tears in the first week. Me and Raj took it in turns to have a little cry every day, it seemed, but it was good that we allowed ourselves to express our emotions, and I was glad that Raj did as well, rather than feeling like I need to be the strong one here for my wife. No, it was about both of us just accepting that we were going through this journey together and being there for each other. So back to kind of thinking about support. So yes, I had family support. We had support from my family and from my husband's family. That was amazing. I had support in the form of text messages and WhatsApp messages from all my friends. And trust me, that really brought a smile to my face. It was really, really encouraging, got me through kind of each day. And I shared when I felt I could about the kind of difficulties I was having. But actually, initially, talking about the labor was not something I wanted to do. The first time I actually spoke about the labor to someone apart from Raj was when that lovely breastfeeding counselor came to my house before we got the tongue tie released. And her first question was, okay, how was the labor? Tell me all about it. And I just remember bursting into tears, because actually you need to give yourself time to process it, no matter what kind of birth it was. And for me, talking to someone apart from Raj really helped me do that. Because at that time, I felt like, yeah, my labor was perfect. It was fine. I didn't realize how much I was still holding in. So it was really kind of useful and healing for me to talk to someone outside of my husband about that. So other forms of support that I had is from the NCT course that I went on. There was a group of 10 couples altogether that went on this course, and we were all at kind of giving birth in a similar time. So that WhatsApp group has been really, really helpful. And I've since joined a walking group with other new moms as well. But there's moms in there that have got an 8-month-old or a year old or a 2-year-old. And that's really helpful as well, because I'm seeing moms on the other side. And it's been really helpful just to kind of hear their stories and hear them say, we were there, I experienced that, don't worry, it gets better, like we survived. So it's been really encouraging, and I'm hoping to start a few more clubs and meet with other moms too. And I think the main thing that I've learned from this is, yes, everyone talks about the village and it takes the village to raise a child. It definitely does. But that village isn't just going to come knocking on your door. You have to be proactive in asking for the support from the village and asking people to be part of your village. For example, keeping up communication with the girls in the NCT group, I have to be an active member of that group to receive support from them. I'm also very generous in giving advice, because I'm one of the moms that has given birth earlier. So our boy is kind of 2 weeks ahead of most of the babies there. So just giving the moms reassurance, turning up for those walks. I could just say, nah, forget it, I'm going to go for my walk anyway. Because initially I was feeling quite kind of scared to go along to this walk, and I just had to do it one day, and the day that I chose, rather than it being a really nice sunny day, it was pouring it down, there was gale force winds, it felt like. I didn't know how to use the rain cover on my pram, but I just thought I need to do it once, otherwise I'll never do it. So it's about putting yourself out there, because there is forms of support, but you have to proactively seek it out. My family, obviously, they were always going to be there, but after like a few weeks, obviously, they wanted us to be independent as well. My mom was like, okay, look, you've got to start slowly getting into your routine. Obviously, we're here, but she eased me into it. And I had to just keep asking for extra help when I needed it. And I needed to be proactive about that again and not feel like, God, it's a sign of weakness if I'm asking my mom for help. And she's been absolutely great in doing so. My sister, both my sisters have been incredible. My younger sister, it's been great to talk to her, because she's getting married in August. So talking to her and doing wedding stuff is like some more normality in my life. And then speaking to my older sister is great, because she will give me all of that encouragement and support to do with raising my little boy. So that's been great. And initially she would literally call me every day and say, oh, do you just want to have a catch up? And I used to think, I don't really have anything to tell you, because the day is the same as yesterday. I fed my baby, I changed his nappy, I rocked him to sleep, he woke up, I fed him, we changed nappy, rocked him to sleep. Like, there's not much interesting going on in my life at the moment. There's nothing I can really tell you about. But actually, every time I'd get off the phone to her, I realized how useful that phone call was, because I'd have the chance. It was almost like I was doing a bit of a reflection out loud, and in that, she'd be able to point out like, oh, well done, like you've done that, that's really good, and that's really good you're doing that. So it was like she gave me words of encouragement, she was able to reflect back to me how far I'd come, and all of that was really, really useful. If there was something I was struggling with and I didn't actually realize, I'd kind of end up talking about it, and she'd be like, oh, you can do this, you can do that. So it was kind of like that daily support on having that reflection that I didn't know I needed, but was really helpful. And my sister was able to give that to me. And my younger sister, yes, doing the wedding planning, that was a great distraction. But also, like, even speaking to her about what she was doing at work, she's a dancer, and catching up with her again, it was just nice to reconnect with the world outside of motherhood, because you still need a little bit of that too. And then actually the thing that I want to end on is the support I've had from my husband. Now, I know everyone's going to be like, oh, your husband's meant to be supportive. That's their role. They're the father of the child. But actually the society that we live in does not expect husbands to do as much as they should. Or actually maybe before, the way that we used to live in communities, it was actually okay for the husband to take a step back. Now that we live in our own homes, in these different family units without extended families, actually it's really important for your husband to support you in a physical, emotional way, practical take away is everything. And that's what my husband has done for me. Not only has he been an amazing father, but he's been the most incredible husband and the best kind of partner on this journey. And we really is the best team player. So every morning he's been excellent in making me my breakfast so that when I come down, I just have to really quickly assemble it. He takes the baby in the mornings. He gets the laundry done in the morning when he wakes up as well, unloads dishwashers. So all those basic little things and tasks around the house are done before I start my day, and so that my 8 day is just basically easier to manage. And the other thing that he's made me do is have the confidence to go out the house. So easing me into that before he went back to work. He had 3 weeks of paternity leave, so we really utilized that time to go out for meals in the daytime, in the evening, go to the shops. And now we feel so much more confident. Actually, we're living the life that we did before we had a baby, but now we get to share it with our little boy. So it's been incredible. So I know everyone says that life totally changes after you have a child, and I totally 100% agree with that. But when you see it to the frame, through the kind of the lens of life becomes richer, which it definitely has for us. Like, I didn't think that our relationship could get any stronger. I could have more love for my husband. And seeing him as a dad definitely has brought a new dimension to our relationship. We work together even better than we have before because we have new challenges every single day. And it's actually been so nice to bring our baby boy into our lives and create this new life together. There was also something that I was really worried about, which was the change in my identity. And I know I'm only still 8 weeks postpartum as I record this episode. I'd actually done quite a lot of work beforehand. So I'd attended a really useful workshop on kind of that shift in identity from when you're a wife, working full-time, kind of a professional, then going to being a full-time mom, and the shifts in identity that happen. Hello, baby. And what I've actually found is, rather than think of it as a kind of shifting identity, it's more like an evolution of my identity. So it's kind of the next stage. So I already have everything I had before, and this is like adding to what it is. So now being a mother is an extra added dimension. And when I, and that's how I've come to understand it. And actually that the thing that I thought I'd be struggling with the change in identity and shift in identity, that's not been something that's troubling me as of yet. But of course, I've still got kind of a year of maternity leave to go, and then I will be returning back to work next March. So I know things will change. There'll be new challenges. There will probably be times where I kind of miss just doing a 9-to-5 and coming home and being able to relax, because motherhood is definitely a 24/7 job. There's no break from it. But at the moment, I'm really seeing it as an extra added dimension to my qualities. And I know that when I go back to work, I will be better for it. Already, I've kind of started developing a greater interest for perinatal mental health, just because I see how much a mother can go through, and that's without even having a diagnosed mental illness. And that brings me on to kind of one of the reasons I wanted to share my story again, kind of going full circle as I come to gathering my thoughts, that it's not about having a diagnosed mental illness that doesn't make your story kind of valid enough or your feelings validated only if you have a diagnosis or a label. Motherhood is a very challenging part in a woman's life. Becoming a mother is a huge step in a woman's life. Becoming parents is a huge step in a couple's life. And there's going to be highs and lows throughout that, which don't need to be pathologized, but that's not to say that they're not going to be difficult. So that's kind of one end of the spectrum, that people, even those that have kind of got lots of support around them, really prepared, there will still be highs and lows. It's inevitable. That's one side of the spectrum. As you become kind of more confident, you will start flourishing, hopefully, in your role as a parent. And then when you look on the other side of the spectrum, yes, if things are working against you, whether it's finances, stress, lack of support, birth trauma, past mental health illness, a family history of mental illness, which may make you more susceptible to have a mental illness when you're under great stress, like at the point of birth or in the postpartum period, then a mental illness may emerge. But it's a spectrum. And again, There's treatment and recovery, which will put you back into a place where you can start flourishing again in your role. So I believe every birth story is a relevant and valid story. And I urge you all that have gone through this, whether it be something that you're still having difficulty talking about, just to talk to one person about it, to lighten that load. And you might actually find that actually that made me feel a little bit better, but I need actually some more professional support. And that's when you can think about having some therapy or speaking to your GP for more specialist input. But even just sharing with that one person again, it might give them the little insight that they need into what motherhood is like, so that they can be more prepared when they reach that stage of life. And again, that's one of the other reasons that I wanted to record this podcast, whether it's about breastfeeding, about the challenges with tongue tie, about how you take all your experiences into that delivery room with you. Hopefully it helps you in some way or another. And if not, hopefully you just enjoyed having a quick listen. I feel like everyone loves a bit of a birth story. So either way, there's something that you can take from it. Obviously, I acknowledge my privileges in that I have a husband who not only is very supportive, but he has a very flexible job. And that's why he's been able to support me as much as possible. I know that if he was still doing a job as a GP, even if he wanted to really help out in the house, it would have just been impossible. And I know even mentally and emotionally, he would not be able to give as much as he's been able to. I'm privileged to live close to my family, my in-laws being quite close as well, having a really good friendship and support system. And the simple things like the area that I live in has very good support networks for women. The midwife I had was excellent. So there's loads of things that have lined up well for me that meant that I could have this positive experience and encounter into motherhood despite having some small challenges along the way. So the reason I did this podcast was because it is Maternal Mental Health Week. I had lots of things lined up, like speaking to the lead psychiatrist in the UK that has been responsible for expansion of perinatal services. I still do hope to record that podcast in the near future and release it. But at the end of my story, I just want to add some information about perinatal mental health. So anyone can experience a mental health problem at the point of pregnancy, during the pregnancy, when they give birth, or afterwards. It's called perinatal mental health or postpartum illness when it's 1 year following birth, and things that can happen. So we hear a lot about postnatal depression. So again, that is not baby blues, but it's when that kind of lack of motivation, no interest in things, poor sleep, poor appetite, suicidal thoughts, thoughts to harm baby, they are kind of there for a prolonged period. So we're saying not just like one day or a fleeting thought, but this is kind of continued for 2 weeks, then we can call it a postnatal depression. So that's an illness that we hear about. Lots of other things that can happen, quite common. Well, I see them commonly in my work. So OCD could be a thing. And I know everyone thinks of OCD as kind of cleanliness and keeping things orderly. But actually, it's when I think about OCD, it's about intrusive thoughts, thoughts that come into your mind, which you recognize as being irrational and illogical, and they cause you distress, but you can't really kind of do anything about them. And sometimes the obsessive thought is associated with a compulsion. So sometimes you might have to do something in order to neutralize that thought. So kind of some examples that are related to mothers could be kind of intrusive thoughts to harm your baby. So you have this thought that you might do something to baby, you know you're not going to act on it, but just having the thought causes you extreme amount of distress. You could have some thoughts that you're a paedophile, and that might make it hard for you to do things like bathing your baby or changing their nappy, because you'll feel guilty for having the thought, that intrusive thought that enters your mind. When these intrusive thoughts do occur, that you never act on them, but it's just having the thought makes you feel extremely distressed. So that can be quite common. There could be some fears around contamination. So you might feel like you're going to infect your baby, or there might be some germs that might lead to excessive cleaning of the baby, which could actually be dangerous for the baby. Their skin might start drying, they might get a rash, things like that. So whenever we think about perinatal illness, it's about looking after the mother and the baby. So the assessment looks at keeping them both well and kind of getting the bonding all right and improving the support system. As with any mental health illness, there's a biopsychosocial approach taken. That means the biological is what medication can be used right now. Obviously, there's more thought given to that because if the mother is breastfeeding, we want to go for a medication that's not going to be passed into the milk to baby, or if it is, in small amounts only, and use the lowest possible dose. So you can still have medication whilst breastfeeding. It's all about weighing up the pros and cons. The psychological support is about having therapy from a psychologist, and then the social side of things is getting family on board, putting everything in place, ensuring the bonding is still going well with baby, and all those other things that are important that when you are a mother as well. So that's a little bit about OCD. Some patients more on the kind of severe end that may require admission to inpatient hospital is if a woman experiences postpartum psychosis. Now, this occurs in every 1 in 1,000 births, a woman will experience a psychotic episode. This will present as the woman hearing voices, seeing things that aren't there, having delusions, which are fixed, unshakable beliefs. So they could have a belief that someone's stolen my baby and replaced it with another baby. This is not my baby. Or they could have thoughts like my baby is a devil or a demon, or that everyone's trying to kill me and my baby, so I need to kind of run away and keep us safe. It could be anything at all. But again, we have to look at safety on mom and baby in that circumstance, because delusion could be around the baby. So hearing things, seeing things, and delusions are kind of the main things. And there could be changes in kind of how they experience emotions, their behaviors, their language, their sleep, and they won't be able to function as they did before. And the management for psychosis is best done in an inpatient setting. And there are mother and baby units which allow for mother and baby to be admitted together so that they aren't separated. Because again, what's really important is that the bonding continues so that the baby will be looked after by a nursery nurse as well. The mother can't do the full care, but the mother is still there in the picture so that that future bonding isn't impacted. If mother and baby units weren't kind of available, what would have happened in the past is that a baby and mother would be separated. What that might mean is someone else takes on the role of the primary caregiver. This could be a mother-in-law, it could be the patient's mother or the husband stepping up. And then when the mother has recovered from a mental illness and returns back, that period for bonding may have lapsed, because a woman can be in hospital for a month, 2 months, 3 months. It really depends on the severity of that episode and how quickly they respond to medication. A woman can present with something called a manic episode, which means that they experience high levels of energy. They feel like they are very happy, on top of the world. Again, they might have some delusions like that God is speaking to them, or they can do everything, or they might have superpowers. They might start spending a lot. There may be some reckless behaviors, maybe hypersexuality. And this manic episode could be the start of a bipolar affective disorder. And some women can have gone through kind of their 20s, 30s without any mental illness, and then they become pregnant, give birth, and they could then have their first episode of a manic episode, which then is later identified as bipolar affective disorder. So the reason I kind of mentioned these illnesses was not to scare any first-time mums or any mums that are going to give birth, but it's really to put that knowledge out there. We're doing really well about talking about mental health illnesses more, but I still feel that these ones are not spoken about. And what's even more important is that the services available are not spoken about, because if someone doesn't know that there is the possibility of going into hospital with their baby, then it might be that they or their family are more forthcoming with seeking support, because they know support is available and it's done in a very compassionate way. So I'm going to leave it there with all the information. I will be happy to answer any questions if anyone has any via my Instagram at Dr. Devika Patel. And there's loads more information that you can find on the internet. If there's more you want to find out about psychosis, I will tag the charity, the leading charity for that. And for any more information, Mind website is an excellent resource which easy to read information that I use to explain difficult concepts to patients as well, so you can check that out. I hope you found this useful episode, found the little baby noises cute that have been part of this beautiful podcast. I hope to keep releasing at least one podcast a month on different topics, mainly going with some solo episodes initially until I feel I were able to carve out some time to do some recordings. So thank you again for supporting this podcast. I look forward to releasing another one very soon.